listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we look at the headlines at consortiumnews.com with Editor-in-Chief Joe Loria. First of all, it was great seeing you in D.C. This was an interesting weekend for sure, and I think something that's going to bear fruit going forward.
It was a terrific weekend, simply by the quality of the people that were there that I met for the first time, many people, the spirit of that march, of that rally in a biting cold wind out in the parking lot at the Pentagon. But it really encapsulated what people who have their heads screwed on right and know about what's going on with American wars, the amount of money that's being wasted, the lives that are being wasted. This is the central problem, really, of our time, because it affects the Pentagon and the spending there, and what they do affects so many lives all over the world and here at home in diverse ways. So to have people come out now, yes, only 1,000 or 1,500 showed up. Those are 1,500 terrific people who know what they're talking about. And the idea is to start spreading this as a spark to make this the main issue that we have to get out on the streets for. This was not your pussy hat anti-Trump kind of march.
Right. Go on, Don. No, you're talking about 1,500 people, say, coming from 50 states. I mean, you're talking about 30 people or somebody going back to just about every county or every other county in the country to organize, because the people that showed up, those are organizers. They're going back home to do some work.
That's right. Cindy Sheehan, of course, became well known as a national figure, as I wrote in my account of this, of the march and rally, when she camped outside Bush's ranch in Texas after her son was killed in that illegal invasion of Iraq. Cindy set this up. I was very happy that she posted my article on her Facebook page to get more attention, because I want people to know about this. And as you just said, this is a beginning of something. And it happened, of course, on the 51st anniversary of the 1967 march on the Pentagon, which started at the Lincoln Memorial. They marched over the Memorial Bridge down to the Pentagon. In those days, you apparently just jumped over a small wall, and they were thousands of protesters were able to march right to the front of the Pentagon, where they were met by some MPs with skinny rifles, M16s, or whatever they had then. And that was far cry from what you see at demonstrations today, if they're large enough. Now, we only had police escort on Sunday. But that demonstration on October 21, 1967, brought 35,000 people to the front of the Pentagon. And there were sustained demonstrations against the war. That was early on in 67, one of the first big demonstrations, if not the first big one. And then it snowballed, and the government had to stop this war eventually.
Yep.
And, you know, there's an interesting picture as I was researching photos for the article I did on. I have a lot of my own photographs of this, of Sunday's march, but I try to look for a few usable pieces, pictures for the article that did not have a copyright restriction. And I found, I saw a picture. Unfortunately, I couldn't use it because it did have a copyright restriction of Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense at the time, pulling back a curtain from his office at the Pentagon, looking down at the protesters. I'd never seen that picture before. I don't know if you have, Don.
What was it, the fog of war? I don't know if I saw that, but I saw a similar photograph. But, you know, to me, it's kind of ugly that when someone like McNamara, who was on the public payroll, inside a public building, taking that great public expense, operating a killing machine funded by the public that operates against the public and the rest of the world, have someone say, well, if you take my picture while I'm doing this, that image belongs to me and you can't use it. It's sick to the point
of
nausea.
Well, that's Getty. Getty owns the image. I know it's a really big one, so they want money for it. Understood. But there were others, like the one I used of the students standing off against
my popper photo,
the soldiers
also Getty,
with the Pentagon, the background. Yeah, that is available only to a nonprofit site like ours. That, if you're not a nonprofit, if you're a newspaper like New York Times, you'd have to pay for that as well. At least Getty has made this available to nonprofits. Right. This is a new thing from a couple of years ago. I appreciate that. But that photo, you know, look, it's the copyright of the photographer and the company that owns it, which is Getty now, because Getty bought up pictures from all different services, obviously. That's how they have such a big library.
Right.
But no, that picture, though, shows that the actual people making the decisions at high levels, like McNamara, inside the Pentagon, they saw what was going on. It reminds me of the tapes of Nixon when he was talking about how he knew that those guys, those demonstrators, were out in Lafayette Park. So, across the street from the White House.
You're right.
So they get the message. That's the only way they get. This is what democracy looks like, was one of the chants on Sunday. Yep. That's people in the street. Because the voting booth and everything else, and the media, of course, being blocking real voices because it represents powerful interests, you have to get out in the street, unfortunately. And let's hope it grows from there, Don. It was a great Sunday. If anything, you feel inspired by this and encouraged, and you know you're not alone in your thoughts. That's another important thing. This feeling of collectiveness, of being together with other human beings from different parts of the country, as you said, many you don't, you've never met before, but that you've seen things the same way, and you come together physically to create a group like that almost spontaneously, is great feeling, and it's the kind of spirit and encouragement that one needs, because you need courage to stand up to these guys because they've got the guns. We only have the signs.
Yep. You know, I'm looking at the comments under the consortiumnews.com. Presentation of the march this past weekend. And by the way, first of all, thank you for covering it. You know, I went there both as a journalist and also, you know, I did some work trying to help organize it. I noticed that the main, I would say, the best funded parts of the so-called progressive press did zero work telling people this march was going to happen, not asking them to come, but telling them that, remember Cindy Sheehan? She's going to the Pentagon and asking women to come and protest this weekend. You know, lots of stuff does get covered by that particular aspect of our press, of the press. I wouldn't call it ours because it doesn't respond to us anymore. But some of the best funded so-called progressive press did nothing to bring people there. And then on Monday after, didn't cover it at all. They did cover
Democracy Now, Don?
Yes, exactly. That's what I'm talking about. Democracy Now! Did not cover this. They did cover a last-minute march outside the White House that was called Monday. That, Matt, or that was, I think, Sunday or Monday. That was called. That got covered. Let's try to defund the Pentagon. Not covered. Not important. Not covered. And even though some of the most favored guests of Democracy Now! Were speakers on the stage, didn't seem to help.
Yeah, it was pretty sad. We're glad that we got a chance to cover it with my story and some pictures, but we also have videos now. I've just posted to the site an interview we did with Jill Stein, and we have to give her credit for coming out and speaking. And so Jill spoke 6 minutes to our videographer, Netra Halperin, who did her first piece for us.
Yep.
Netra's also putting a package together of the whole speech, of the whole rally with the music and marching and some of the in other interviews she did with people, not just Jill. That will be being posted shortly. So, yes, it's a sad state of affairs in a so-called progressive media if they didn't think that this was a story worth covering, worth going to, having a presence there. Very sad.
Yep. Well, I mean, what it does do, though, is point out that, okay, well, there's something to be done. Because if we look at, you know, the material condition around us, I don't know, a lot of people that keep the atomic clock data think we are closer to war with Russia than we have ever been, including October of 1962, you know, the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
Including, you know, one of the most,
Stephen Cohen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Stephen Cohen, one of the most preeminent experts on U.S.-Russia relations. And a lot of other folks, and anyone actually that pays attention to this realizes it, because the United States military is deployed to Russia's borders for the first time since 1917, really, from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula, to the middle of the Korean Peninsula. And they're drilling, and they have weapons hot, and you have this Russiagate rhetoric across the political spectrum in the United States and across Europe also, and across Japan and South Korea, to the extent they can make that work. There's a lot of places where it's falling, including in Europe and in Korea. I mean, Korea is making its own peace outside of the control of the United States. People are making it like they're doing that despite Trump, but they actually started doing it despite Obama. And Trump, to his credit, has been standing aside and letting it happen.
Well,
in Europe, you have other movements like that. Yeah, it's a very confused picture.
I didn't mention in my piece, I might add it. Saturday, the day before the march, Trump announced the U.S. will be pulling out of the intermediate range nuclear missile treaty, which is a disaster. Yeah. And this is John Bolton's doing. So
yes, it is. Yeah,
pushed
that's true.
Trump over the edge here. This treaty, and I was in Europe, actually. I was living in Germany in 1984 when there were a lot of demonstrations then against these Persian 2 cruise missiles that the U.S. had deployed in Western Europe.
Yes.
So the Russians countered with the SS-20s. And it was a very tense period right now, when the idea was that the normally the half hour or the 45 minutes, whatever, that Russia would have had to respond to a nuclear attack was cut down to like 10 minutes, because if they were launched from Western Europe, they had to decide in 10 minutes whether this was a real attack or not.
Yeah, there was the whole deployment thing was like a major political crisis in Europe at the time. And I think I told you, in 1990, I was standing in Red Square with a friend of mine who was pointing to the buildings around Moscow where the ministries were located, you know, because the Soviet Union had the political and economic elite sort of overlapped. And this is where, you know, the head of the Ministry of Manufacturing, head of Agriculture and blah, 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 they were on the top of these buildings. And my friend explained to me that, okay, it takes 18 minutes from a launch warning from the top floor of that building where the head of the economy will go into the silo, 18 minutes from the top, down the elevator, into the hardened place where, on a nuclear attack, they could survive. It takes 12 minutes for the missile to get here from Western Germany.
Yeah.
That was the state of mind of the Soviet government from the time they deployed those missiles, the cruise missiles, into West Germany and elsewhere. And that treaty was a product of that time frame. And while that happened, Matthew Rust, I don't know if you remember him.
Of course I do. Flew into the Red Square, landed the plane.
Flew a little, what was it, like a Piper Cub or something into Red Square. Yeah. So, you know, that situation is, you know, still prevails. And then there is the counter. You know, the U.S. has been violating these, you know, different treaties and abrogating them at will. And Putin, I don't know, a few months back said, hey, you know, good. You know, you guys are doing that. By the way, we got some new stuff. Want to see it? And he rolled some of the things out like, well, we have a drone that can fly under the ocean now and you know, drop a nuclear bomb wherever we want, here, there, or whatever. So do you guys really want to go to war?
And that's not the missile that Bolton says that they're violating this INF treaty, is it? Do you know that?
What he described is not an INF violation.
Okay.
Because INF is intermediate range nuclear forces.
This is very long range.
Yeah.
And it could fly around mountains and everything. I just hope, for the sake of world peace, that they really can have that's really an existent weapon.
Who knows?
But I did want to say that the day before the March, INF was Trump made that statement, and the idea that Stephen Cohn is being vilified is just alarming. It's chilling. That tells you something. He knows more about Russia and American relations than anybody in this country, pretty much. He's right up there anyway, and he's well respected academically, but popularly now in the press, he's being smeared because he's questioned Russiagate, and that he's just part of the same neo-McCarthyism that Jill Stein talked about on Sunday. That has overtaken us, and that is part and parcel to the war strategy. More and more that I think about this, if they want to get rid of if the U.S. wants to put those intermediate range missiles back into Western Europe or in Europe now, in Eastern Europe, since it's part of NATO, right, as you say.
Right.
It's much closer now, the dividing line is much closer to Moscow than it was back in the first Cold War. If the United States really wants to do that, if Bolton really wants to do that, combined with this, whether or not the Russiagate story collapses in the end, which I believe very much it will, it's in the people's minds that's been reinforced that Russia is the enemy. That's what the whole, I think, part of the PSYOPs, if you can call it that, was about. Make sure American people are convinced Russia is the enemy. So if we have to go to war, if we can find a way to go to war with limited nukes that will not have the same kind of damage as before, smaller warheads, make it easier to use, then we'll have the population behind us. That's what's so dangerous about Russiagate, why it had to be challenged, why Bob Perry, our founder of Consortium News, was in the forefront of that. We've tried to keep that legacy going. And because I wrote while he was still alive, some pieces questioning Russiagate. So that is why that Russiagate story had to be challenged. It's all a big mess, Don. It's getting frightening, you know. It's like the back of your mind, could the United States really want to launch a nuclear war, limited so-called nuclear war in Russia? Is there such a thing as a limited nuclear war? Could they even think about doing that? And, you know, some days I really think it could happen. That's very frightening.
Pretty scary, isn't it? You know, you're talking about the psychological warfare, actually. Let's move. That's a good way to move forward to the next thing. Psyched at the American Psychological Association, Professor Michael Brenner's piece at consortiumnews.com. And by the way, we're speaking with Joe Loria, who is the editor-in-chief at consortiumnews.com. You know, there's a lot of interesting things around the APA, the American Psychological Association. To me, the most important thing has been the repeated attempts to diagnose Donald Trump as loony from afar. After including the APA, a number of professional associations said, look, we're actually professionals, okay? We don't watch TV and then decide if somebody's crazy this way, that way, or the other. We do diagnostics, we do scientific tests, et cetera, but then large numbers of the constituency of these groups sign letters to the editor or whatever, which are political, not clinical, and enter into the public sphere. This is different right here, although it kind of describes the same kind of power play between the CIA and Pentagon and doctors talking about Guantanamo.
Well, that's right. Well, Michael Brenner, professor at the University of Pittsburgh, has went to this AAPA convention in San Francisco and wrote this really well-written, kind of delightful piece about horrible issues. And one of them, as you just mentioned, was whether psychologists can really diagnose someone from afar. And there were five panels at that convention on Trump and his supposed madness. But at least one of the participants talked about the APA's gold order rules. And the gold order rules state that it's unethical for psychiatrists to give a professional opinion about public figures whom they have not examined in person.
Right.
That's from Wikipedia. So if you, as you say, if you don't sit down with Trump and analyze him and have him go through tests and spend time with him, and I don't have a lot of faith in psychiatry or psychology myself. I've never been a big believer in it. This piece made me even less, confirm my total skepticism that I've had almost my entire life about this. Although I loved reading Freud, I think he was a great writer, and I loved Eric Fromm because he talked about social psychology.
Karen Horney.
So there's a lot of value. There's been value in those old guys, and I read that when I was very, very, very young. In my teenage years. So, but since then, I kind of lost lost the appeal for me. But so you can't psychoanalyze somebody if you don't have them there as your patient. That's the rule, but they're doing it anyway. But more dangerous, more disturbing in this story was the reaction to the news that a certain number of psychologists had been on the payroll of the Department of Defense to take part in the enhanced interrogation, aka torture, of people at Guantanamo. And if you remember when that broke because the Congress showed a little guts and published a redacted version of the Senate torture report that the CIA, in fact, spied on the Senate Intelligence Committee while they were putting together their report. Totally illegal, of course. That also came out. All these scandals that seemed to just get swept away under the rug within a few weeks. But that was recalled in this piece. And the part of the APA, American Psychology Association, rebelled against the other part, saying that they should never, no psychologist should ever have anything to do with the military, and particularly psychology, being an active participant in torture. So they had a vote at this convention. This was in August. This took place in San Francisco because a bunch of these jackasses and the APA are trying to go through the back door into Guantanamo. Since that scandal broke, they were, of course, no longer part of the program. So to get back in, they're pretending that these poor people, these poor inmates there need psychological care. So they want to go in there and help them. Well, you know what? The vast majority of the people who voted there voted against that because they saw it as the ruse that it is. It was just another way to get back into Guantanamo and under the guise of going to help these inmates when the fear was, of course, they would continue to help with the rough treatment, psychological and physical treatment of these prisoners who've never really gotten their day in court, of course, who were taken off the battlefield in Afghanistan. Many have been proven to have been totally innocent. But this is the disgrace, the continuing Guantanamo that Obama said he would shut down, that's still open. So this resolution was defeated. However, there's an addendum and an update that I need to post to this story. Because Ray McGovern, I love this piece, and he knew somebody who's in the APA, and he sent the story to her, and she leaked to us a letter from the president of the American Psychological Association, this very APA, to the Defense Department, in which this president, the newly elected president, says that vote not to send the psychologist back into Guantanamo was not enforceable. It was only aspirational.
Right.
Now, that's news for the people who voted against it. So this is the unbelievable nature of these people, of the Americans, who are supposed to be committed to public health, to helping people. They want to get back into Guantanamo in such a way because of the contracts. It's about money. Always is, isn't it?
For sure.
So this story, really, I really recommend you readers to go and read this because it's really disturbing. And there's a lot of other funny stuff in there, too. It's a very well-written piece. But this is the essence of it, what happened with the psychologists and Guantanamo and how they're faking out their own members to try to get back in there.
And from there, let's go into, to me, this is, I think, one of the most interesting things we've discussed. The seven, the name of the article at consortiumnews.com is 7 days in September, but that is clearly, which you authored, by the way.
That's right.
Cribbed from 7 days in May, the John Frankenheimer film, 1964, and you know, this is an all-star thing. Rod Serling wrote the screenplay, right. Burt Lancaster, Kirk Douglas, Ava Gardner, Frederick Marsh, where you had, in essence, a coup that, by the way, I mean, this movie was released February 12th of 1964, but it was produced during 1963. And just to remind people, President John F. Kennedy was removed from office by assassination on November 22nd of 1963. All of this was shot and in the can before that. And if you watch the movie and keep that in mind, it'll raise a lot of questions in your head. But the thing that's interesting here is it takes that stuff and lays it into September of this past year, where
last month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Like, we're talking about 5 weeks, 6 weeks ago, the first 7 days of September of 2018, where the ongoing, I've been saying this since November 9th, really, of 2016, there's been an ongoing regime change operation by some forces within the U.S., whether you call them deep state, intel, whoever the hell they are. It's obvious some people were trying to thwart the outcome of the election and are doing everything possible to remove Trump from office. And it's not over him being an Islamophobe, a racist, whatever, grabber, etc., but rather over his desire for detente with Russia and China and to reconfigure the international position of the United States, in the world. That is the problem that is voiced daily. They called him a traitor for not coming out of a summit with Putin, for example, in an aggressive posture. That, to me, is really frightening.
It is indeed. I want to first start by saying something about that film. John F. Kennedy read the novel, 7 days in May. And then when John Frankenheimer got the film, he asked Kennedy if he could shoot within the White House. And Kennedy, unprecedentedly, and apparently it's never happened before since, he opened the White House 5 days to Frankenheimer to film inside the actual White House, those scenes in the Oval Office with Burt Lancaster, Frederick March, and others. That's the actual White Oval
kidding.
Office.
No kidding, wow.
You could see the fireplace by now. I have a little clip, a two-minute clip that is just that's 2 minutes, 25 seconds. It's a fantastic scene between Lancaster. And basically, this was the novel is, it was a military coup that was being planned against the President of the United States.
Yep.
And this, when Kennedy came into office, of course, he knew very well that he got stuck with the Bay of Pigs, which had been planned by Eisenhower and Richard Nixon, vice president. And then he it blew up in his face, and he refused the Pentagon's pressure to put to increase to put air support for these Gusano rebels that were sent in to invade Cuba. And the thing was, of course, a disaster. Kennedy owned it. He took responsibility. Pentagon never forgave him for that. When the Cuban Missile Crisis occurred, we saw the same thing, that same kind of unbelievable pressure, some generals wanting him to actually perhaps go to war with Russia if necessary to end that missile crisis.
Yep.
So Kennedy knew what he's up against, and this novel was written about that very situation. It's very thinly disguised, who the president is and what's going on. So Kennedy allowed the filming to take place in the White House. So what I saw in the first 7 days of September of 2018, last month, were three events that reminded me very much, finally, of this situation, where you had unelected officials openly, for the first time, admitting they're trying to undermine, if not remove, the constitutionally elected president. And that is a dangerous move, even though I think Trump is dangerous. I don't support Trump. It's not about that. I even quote Masha Gessen here from The New Yorker, who's totally against Putin and hates Trump. Masha Gessen, she writes that having this state of affairs described in print. Now, I'm going to refer first to the three things that happened before I get to Masha Gessen. And that was one, the Robert Woodward book that came out, the first excerpts came out on September 4th. Then the next day was the op-ed piece, anonymously an op-ed piece in the New York Times, which a senior Trump official, Trump administration official admits that they have done things to undermine him, to control him, to manipulate him. And that, as you pointed out, Don, he says that Trump's done great things when it came to deregulation and tax cuts, everything great for the billionaires. It was his Russia policy that concerns them.
Right.
It's clearly written in that op-ed piece. No longer do we have any speculate. We need to speculate anymore that this is what they're against him about.
Right.
They clearly state it. And, you know, people have always felt that the power, there's always a power behind the throne in any government in the history of the world, practically. But you could read Shakespeare about powers behind the throne.
Yeah, and not and just that. It's amplified.
Now we've got evidence of it.
Right. That's amplified by the voice in the New York Times. The New York Times editorials themselves in support of that said, and they're right, Trump is doing this, this, and this. That's all great. This is horrible, and it's dangerous. We got about a minute, so we got to wrap it up.
Yeah, before we had that op-ed, we had a series of leaks, of course, coming from the Obama intelligence officials to try to undermine Trump. We saw a real concerted effort by the then ruling party, the Democrats, to try to undermine first a candidate and then an elected president. And this is very dangerous because, as Masha Gessen says, that even in the short run, it might solve our problems, but it undermines the cherished ideals of the U.S. because an anonymous person cannot give govern for the people because people don't know who's governing. We need to know who's governing. This is absolutely. Then the other one was the Obama speech that he made in that first week, first 7 days of September,
right,
in which he, a former president, broke all the rules about attacking his predecessor. So I'm also raising, though, at the very end, the question, though, in Woodward's book, apparently they stopped Trump, if we can believe it, from assassinating Assad, Bashar al-Assad in Syria. So I end my article with this dilemma. If, in fact, a president is crazy enough to want to do something like that, to start perhaps a war with Russia, is it right then for the people behind him to stop it? And I leave the article there as an open question.
Joe Loria, editor-in-chief of ConsortiumNews.com. Thank you very much. Talk to you next week.
You're welcome, Don. Good talk.
Thanks, Abe. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. On this unique edition of Crosstalk, we review a new and very important book, John Mearsheimer's The Great Delusion, Liberal Dreams, and International Realities. It's a real bombshell. Crosstalking The Great Delusion, Liberal Dreams, and International Realities. I'm joined by my guest here in Moscow, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Dmitry Bobich. He's a political analyst with Sputnik International. And we have Glenn Deason. He is a professor at the Higher School of Economics, as well as author of The Decay of Western Civilization and Resurgence of Russia. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Okay, Glenn, let me go to you first here. I'm a really big fan of Mearsheimer's work. He is a real list. What does that mean?
Well, in political theory, we essentially have two main theories. The political realists, they believe that, to explain how states behave, they see it as essentially being dependent on external situations. So there's no good state or bad state. Everyone acts based on the international distribution of power. So in this contrast with liberal theory, in which we look more at the internal characteristics of states, so whether or not they're democratic, if they have economic interdependence, if they
human
have strong
rights,
institutions, yeah, human rights.
Values.
So essentially you have these two theories which compete against each other to explain how the world works.
And Mearsheimer calls this liberal hegemony, and he says it's doomed to fail, Mark.
Yeah, this is in many ways Mearsheimer's magnum opus of what has now been several decades of his fierce critique of U.S. Foreign policy, basically since the end of the Cold War, and how it has emerged not only as the hegemon in terms of power, but has quite, I would say, selectively use that power to try to reshape the world in its own image rather than, say, the more realist notion of balancing power centers and trying to present another hegemon from emerging regionally. It has delved into an ideology of exceptionalism, which Mearsheimer identifies as just another type of nationalism. And he also specifically addresses the way that liberals have not only dominated the foreign policy in terms of action, but the inner circle, such that there isn't, realists are no longer even really accepted in the discourse. It's something that's taught in universities and then immediately rejected in favor of liberalism and its antecedent, on the other hand, the neocons.
But this whole liberal approach to international relations, as Glenn mentioned, I mean, it sounds nice and warm and fuzzy. Yeah, if you have the power, why not try to support human rights? If you have the power, have fair trading relationships, but it never works out that way. Mearsheimer would argue that it makes things even worse because these end up being wars of choice. Go ahead, David.
Well, I think that Mearsheimer is very soft-spoken. He stays more or less in the framework of politically correct language. I mean, hegemony, oh, yes. Well, I think that what he calls governing, this is from a review of that book by the American conservative. A dagger, they called it a dagger, pointed at the heart of America's governing philosophy, progressive liberalism. Well, I think that you should call a spade a spade. Progressive liberalism, or ultra-liberalism, as I call it now, it's not even a governing philosophy in the United States. It's a totalitarian ideology which determines not only the state's action, but which determines education, arts, sports, and of course foreign policy, and of course military policy. So when, for example, Mearsheimer writes about the United States, obviously, the state's militaristic behavior is almost certain to end up threatening its own liberal values. Yeah. Liberalism abroad leads to illiberalism at home, end of quote. Well, it's not just illiberalism, putting people like Chelsea Manning in jail for life, organizing a worldwide chase for Edward Snowden. This is not illiberalism.
The ideology that Mearsheimer is criticizing promotes, for example, the war in Syria. It promotes the illegal regime change in Ukraine in 2014. Because if you look at this liberal hegemony, and it's really surprising to me that when you get into an argument, with a counter position to the things I've just mentioned, they all have this de facto default position of, I'm an illiberal person because I'm not going to project my values. I mean, they're not even self-aware of that. Okay, go ahead, Glenn.
No, there's nothing, democracy, human rights, these are all good things, but they have to be based on power foundations. Otherwise, because this is essentially, from the realist mind at least, what drives international politics. Now, Mark mentioned that the realist had to some extent been purged out of the discipline from after the Cold War, and this, there were systemic incentives for this, of course, because during the Cold War it made sense to look at things through this balance of power. However, if you would still follow this theory after the Cold War, then you would have to see the West was now overwhelmingly powerful, the Soviet Union didn't exist anymore. If we then follow this theory, then the logic suggests we should start to pull back and essentially dismantle NATO, which is what essentially people like Mearsheimer, Waltz, and others have argued. However, then had these systemic incentives for liberals, because they said, no, actually, we create peace by expanding NATO because we're promoting democracy, we're promoting human rights. We should actually go and topple governments around the world because that's a good way of promoting democracy. So, as you mentioned, it's a nice idea that, if you go out and promote democracy as a form of security, because democracies apparently don't go to war with each other, then everyone benefits. But at the end of the day, you see that it essentially undermines any self-insight or any sympathy for anyone else. Because, again, if you look at the establishment, no one can
Look at the history of American foreign policy since the end of the Cold War. It has just been a trail of tears for the people that are on the receiving end of it. Mark.
Yeah, democracies don't go to war with each other except when they do. Ahem, U.S. attack on Serbia. No, I don't agree that the pursuit of democracy and human rights in international relations is any way a good thing.
I think what Glenn is saying is, I mean, if that can be attained, okay, without use of violence, I mean, defending and promoting ideas, it's the actions to promote democracies that I got a problem with.
First of all, it's obvious selectivity and hypocrisy. The U.S.'s biggest allies in the Middle East are the powerful liberal democracies of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Bahrain.
And UAE.
And the United Arab Emirates. The U.S. supplies, under successive regimes of liberal foreign policy, the U.S. arms over 70% of the world's dictatorships, according to U.S. researchers, and they're trying to cut Russia out of the remaining 25% that Russia and China share amongst them. So, it's really a case of liberal foreign policy is an exercise in hypocrisy. It's weaponized liberalism as a means of demonizing propaganda for my enemies and for my dictator friends. Well, we all see the press coverage that Mohammed bin Salman and Saudi Arabia.
It's really interesting because it really is a PR trap. Because even if it fails, like Iraq, mm-hmm. Afghanistan, Syria, what's going on with Saudi Arabia, it's still your intentions were good, okay? Well, and that's why no one loses their job on cable TV in the U.S. Go ahead.
It's not the first time that lofty ideas lead to the most terrible results. In fact, the worst wars in the life of humanity were led for lofty ideas. I mean, the Napoleonic Wars, which destroyed Europe in the beginning of the 19th century, they were all formally about spreading Republican values and enlightenment and humanism. And even wise people like Heinrich Heine, the famous German poet, even they kind of got lured into this trap. Basically, I just love this this quote from Mearsheimer. A crusader impulse is deeply wired into the liberal democracies, especially their elites, end of quote. Well, this is something that a lot of Muslims don't understand. When the Western democracies came to them with arms, weapons, and wars, beginning from the 90s, they initially thought the Crusaders are back with their Christian ideas. No, the Crusaders, but not with Christian ideas, with something much worse.
Liberalism.
With something very, very detached from Christianity, from tradition, something utopian, and something terrible.
Dima hits on it exactly, which is, again, the problem with exporting democracy and liberalism. It's universalism. Whether you're talking liberalism today, Christianity at one time, communism at another time, it's Napoleonic the universalist, yes. The crusading impulse, the desire to force other people to live to save them. That is what is so terrible about a liberal foreign policy. And Mearsheimer even says, although he contradicts himself later, that he prefers a liberal style of government instead of home.
At home.
But in the anarchic world of international politics with no world government, competing power centers, it is a recipe for militarism and imperialism and disaster.
And a loss of rights at home.
I would just push back on one thing Mark mentioned, and I think Mearsheimer would agree with me, let's say that you have human rights, democracy, but if it's founded on power, then it would be fine. For example, after the Cold War, let's say we would have created a greater Europe based on Gorbachev's common European ideas. Home. So everyone becomes part of the same club, and we agree on certain humanitarian standards or democratic freedoms.
A Wilsonian. You're a Wilsonian.
Yeah, no, but that might have worked. But instead, we developed
to make the world secure for democracy. Forever. The Wilsonian.
No, but instead, it became an instrument of power. So essentially, now we can expand and using democracy as a reason. So again, very much as a new civilizing mission. So the new white man's burdens to go out and bring democracy to the the poor of the other of the rest of the world.
And what hold that. But we're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on John Mearsheimer's new book. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World
on CPR.
Let me go back to Glenn here. It was getting a bit heated there, and everyone's trying to grab space here. Continue your point, my friend.
Well, I was just going to make the point that according to this new liberal theory and even liberal ideology, there's less scope for compromise, because if you have, if there's realists, you can always agree that you should have a balance and you can reach a compromise. But for the liberals, if you think that you know, spreading your empire, your liberal empire, will bring perpetual peace, then any compromise with your adversary is essentially appeasement. And so instead, you have this incentive to pursue a perpetual war in order to achieve perpetual peace. And I think that's what makes them so dangerous, that you can't compromise, you can't negotiate. This essentially goes against the whole idea that we can actually reach this point where the world becomes this peaceful, democratic utopia. So that's my main concern.
That's a fascinating point, because compromise means evil. You can't compromise
with evil, with certain evils, we can compromise with Saudi Arabia, just not Russia and China.
we'll explain that, okay?
It's simply because Saudi Arabia, other countries, Qatar, Bahrain, long ago geopolitically aligned themselves with U.S. foreign policy interests. It's not the principle that matters when you're considering whether to align yourself with illegal countries, whether you're considering Saudi Arabia or Russia or China or, you know, any Turkey or any number of countries. It's not principle that actually determines it. It's just rank hypocrisy. It's a lie they tell and believe themselves.
That's why you need all these think tanks in Washington, D.C.
It's really about geopolitics, because realism describes the real world, and liberalism describes a made-up world and a made-up set of conditions of human nature. Realism, and Mearsheimer elaborates on this, you know, realism views the world that we are all social animals, that we are born into a culture, a society, and we naturally interact with each other. Liberalism views that we are all this atomized individuals who think about and sign social contracts with each other. And this erroneous assumptions about human nature lie at the fault of liberalism to be a theory for foreign policy in the world, real world, and that failure to act on the real world and real human nature leads to the disastrous consequences, war, inevitable violence, and tensions that arise with a liberal foreign policy.
Well, Mark raised an important issue. Why did the United States, as a liberal power, ally themselves with Saudi Arabia? This is the question that a lot of Russian establishment figures, a lot of Russian elite is asking. If Saudi Arabia can be an ally, why can't we? Mm. Well, the answer, I think, is the following. Saudi Arabia will never be a truly independent sovereign state. With their elite, with the kind of morals that they have...
Well, it's a family. It's not a state, it's a family.
They will always depend. In the same way, the United States could ally itself with mild China in the 70s, but it cannot ally itself with more or less normal China of today. So basically what happens is that Russian elite will have to make a choice. You know, they wanted to have good relations with the United States. They tried to accommodate the United States for many years. The whole idea was that if they want money, we will give money. If they want territory, you know, to develop oil and gas, we can do it together. Why aren't you doing that? Well, because these people don't want only your money. They want to change you.
They want your soul.
They want your soul. They want to change you profoundly. And in that sense, you know, when Glenn said that, you know, that Wilsonian idea to make the world safe for democracy, the result is that the world is not safe first for other countries, and then in the end it becomes unsafe for democracy too. So when, for example, even some Russian diplomats say, we have no ideological differences with the United States or with the West. No, we do. Because the whole difference is methods. George F. Kennan said that it was the most important thing about ideology, methods. Russia does not want to change other countries, modeling them in its own image. The United States wants, and here I think Mearsheimer gives that excellent quote from George W. Bush exactly before the invasion of Iraq, how George Bush saw Iraq.
A liberated Iraq can show power of freedom to transform that vital region by bringing hope and progress into the lives of millions. America's interest in security and America's belief in liberty both lead in the same direction, to a free and peaceful Iraq. End of quote. He forgot to add, with ISIS, with a lot of other things,
the law of unintended consequences here. Another famous, but I think flawed, because Mearsheimer's not flawed, but a flawed writer, Francis Fukuyama. We still have this, the last man and the end of history. I mean, people dismiss the book, as they should, but that's still kind of the genetic code of liberalism.
No, we dismiss the book. Actually, it was heralded by the liberal elites.
I know, I thought it was an awful book, and I think the thesis is awful. It's completely wrong, and I think Mearsheimer is right.
He keeps revising it, by the way.
Oh, he just made a lot of money off of it, even trashing his own book here. But that's my point here. It's messianic, is that when you have a messianic view of the world, you can't tweak it. Because it's perfect, it's sacred, it's a deity in and of itself. And any doubting of it, it collapsed completely. Go ahead.
No, but it was a kind of a beautiful theory for liberal hegemony, because what it really said, this last man, end of history, the thesis was that now all ideologies were exhausted, there was only one left, that was liberal democracy, and every country, if they wanted to matter in the world, they would have to embrace it, and everyone would follow under U.S. leadership and essentially try to emulate its model. And again, this is, I think it's important you point that book out, because it's been at the foundation of this liberal delusion, which Mearsheimer points to. And I think, therefore, one of the main issues that Mearsheimer looks at is the Western relationship with Russia, because this has probably been the most toxic of this liberal hegemony. Because from a realist perspective, every realist, even Kennan, well, especially Kennan, George Kennan, that is, they recognize that, you know, if you expand the world's largest military alliance up to Russia's borders, Russia will be very anxious. It will start to push back. And when it pushes back, for a mutual security, the best thing is to get a settlement in place and try to recognize, okay, let's not cross this border. Let's find a mutually beneficial solution. But under this liberal delusion, what we're seeing is, oh, well, we're just promoting democracy. Russia hates democracy. It's afraid of democracy.
They hate our values.
Yeah, they hate our values. But by allowing Russia to essentially balance us, this is the biggest threat to peace, and we have to defeat them. That is the logic. So the idea that liberalism is this peaceful ideology or theory, it's
liberal hegemony. You can recast it in a different way. First of all, the United States and its imperium, they are postmodernist when it comes to international relations. Russia is a modernist, okay? Because they believe in borders, okay? The West says they believe in values, okay? And then the method, right?
This is really interesting. Let's talk about another book that dovetails on with this.
Well, this is a lot like our book club now.
Stephen Walt, who is a political ally of John Mearsheimer, his book came out at the same, just a month afterward. The Hell of Good Intentions, America's Foreign Policy Elite, and the Decline of U.S. Primacy. And he has previously collaborated with John Mearsheimer on a piece critiquing the corrosive influence of Israeli influence in Washington, right? And they were pretty much exiled from D.C., you know, after that because of its ill reception. If you go on YouTube, you can find there's a video from Harvard's Belfer Center. The liberal world disorder reflects on grand strategy and not so great assumptions. This is Walt and Mearsheimer together discussing both of
realism
on steroids. Right? You have a liberal voice to challenge them there as well. I strongly suggest you watch that video. And we have this zinger in there from Walt. Liberal hegemony is a full employment strategy for the U.S.'s foreign policy elite. And I think it's really great. He also develops the idea, what you're talking about, how liberalism, it actually erodes the foundations of what a state is, because the liberal elite, their cosmopolitan nature, they don't believe in borders. That, you know, their free flow of people, of value spread across the world, they don't actually care, for the idea of a nation. They're at the end of the day opposed to it. And because of that, Mearsheimer analyzes in his book, he focuses on this trifecta and how they interact with each other: realism, liberalism, and nationalism.
Nationalism, that's, you got it. That,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
The thing is, these liberal hegemons, Dima, you don't have to know anything about culture. You don't have to know anything about nations. You don't have to know anything about
foreign languages.
Nothing, because your values are your guiding light, okay?
Exactly.
And you were absolutely right, and you must defeat the heathen and convert everyone using the sword, if necessary.
Inside every black, brown, and yellow person is a little white liberal consumer just waiting to be freed with the good truth of liberalism.
Mark just paraphrased me. Go ahead.
When I walked in Moscow in the 90s as a translator for a Wall Street correspondent here, she said that the first thing she heard from her bosses when she went to Moscow, she asked if she had to learn Russian, they said, let's not make it a language club. Very soon, all the world will be speaking English. You know, what I'm afraid of in this liberal hegemonism, it's tendency to have a monopoly and tendency to have government intervention. Because this is exactly what Mearsheimer writes in his books. He basically divides liberals into the so-called modus vivendi liberals, you know, from the times of John Locke, the ones that I have nothing against, and the so-called progressive liberals, who say that a government action is required to promote positive rights, meaning gender rights, all these things that we know about. So this is what this is the way towards totalitarianism. When basically you have an ideological monopoly, in the end you end up having monopolies in economy, like all of these transnational companies, you know, high-tech companies. You have a monopoly in science, which is detrimental to science. And basically, you have government interfering everywhere, fighting fake news.
We've run out of time, but everything you just said, Dima, what it ends up being in toto is intolerance.
Exactly.
That's what it becomes, and monopoly. Gentlemen, that's all the time we have here. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow, and thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.